Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Linked to the rising call for equality worldwide, women's sports had been gaining much attention before the new coronavirus appeared. The Women's World Cup in France fueled Americans' interest in soccer, or as the sport is more commonly known, football. As the United States won the championship series at a sports center in France, the crowd cheered and began to shout "equal pay" over and over again. The U.S. women's team accuses the U.S. Soccer Federation of sex discrimination in pay. The team has taken legal action against the governing body of the sport in the U.S. The Professional National Women's Soccer League is home to many of the U.S. team's players. Before the virus began spreading, the league was expecting to open its eighth season with a new television contract. In addition, women's professional softball was looking toward softball's return to the Olympics for the first time since 2008. Pro volleyball, especially popular in Europe, Russia, and Brazil, similarly receives a lot of public attention in an Olympic year. However, the spread of the coronavirus to almost every country appears to have put a stop to women's progress in the sports world. Now the question is whether players will lose the gains they had made when life returns to normal. Sherry Kempf heads the National Pro Fast Pitch Softball League. She says the men's side of the sports industry will not suffer as much as the women's because it has more money and power to start. The men can sail through the coronavirus health crisis, she suggested. The losses for women athletes are already taking place. Recently, in Colombia, the Independiente Santa Fe soccer team announced it would suspend all player contracts for its women's team. The male players, it added, would only face pay cuts. The effects of the disease COVID-19 on the U.S. economy could look like those that resulted from the 2008 recession. Back then, the Houston Comets of the Women's National Basketball Association was seeking a new owner, but could not find a buyer. The WNBA also cut back on the number of teams. Whirlpool, the maker of many household products, withdrew plans to support women's professional soccer, which was launched in 2009 and lasted just 3 seasons. The WNBA is in better shape today than many women's sports because of its ties with the National Basketball Association. The WNBA has postponed the start of its season, set for May 15th, but Commissioner Kathy Engelbert recently suggested it might be able to return sooner rather than later. But there are concerns among those who are not so well positioned. Kelsey Robinson plays for the U.S. women's volleyball team that was set to compete at the Olympics this summer. Now, the Tokyo Summer Games will begin in July of 2021. Robinson usually can get paid by playing overseas, like many national team players. But those games have been suspended. She says she worries about earning money by playing volleyball. It's hard to say what will happen in Turkey or China, where there are pretty strong economies for sport. But for sure, Italy, I know, will have to decrease salaries. Maybe not at the top team, but I'm sure it'll affect lower teams, Robinson said. We're not finishing the season right now or playing, so that's a hard financial burden. And, she said, decisions about pay levels next year can greatly depend on how the team finishes the current season. Yael Averbusch-West is executive director of the National Women's Soccer League, NWSL, Players Association. She says players' fears about losses are reasonable. I think that everybody is afraid of that, and especially right now, looking at women's soccer and coming off of what we feel is a huge positive momentum after the World Cup, she said. The International Soccer Players Union, FIFPro, warns of the effect the coronavirus could have on women's soccer worldwide. Who knows what the future will bring, said Jody Taylor. She plays for the NWSL's Reign and England's national team and serves on the FIFPro Player Council. She said the reality of the future is worrisome, adding, and one that the world's kind of sitting back and waiting for. Players in individual sports could be hit hardest. Tennis, golf, and track athletes are largely dependent on competing to earn money. The Women's Tennis Association has announced plans to begin play on July 13th. I'm Katie Weaver.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Exercise is an important part of staying healthy, both physically and mentally. Studies show that it can help strengthen the body's natural defenses against disease. But exercise does not just keep us healthy. For many people, it is part of their daily routine, making them feel better about themselves. Getting enough exercise at difficult times, such as the current coronavirus pandemic, is important. However, because of the current restrictions and social distancing, some ways of exercising have changed or are simply gone. So, people are changing how they exercise during this pandemic. Those who only exercise indoors might now consider moving their exercise routine outdoors. This is the advice of Joe Cabaza, a doctor and heart specialist at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. "Simply walk outside in nature," Cabaza said. "People can use this as an opportunity to exercise in other ways. But in areas with stay-at-home orders or enforced social distancing, exercising outside may not be as simple as it sounds. Under a stay-at-home order, Only essential activity is permitted. Most stores are closed, but people are permitted to leave their home for food and fuel, to see a doctor, or for recreation. In most places, going outside for exercise or other forms of recreation comes with restrictions. For some people, the restrictions seem complex and even conflicting, and some people are simply not following them. Reuters news agency recently reported that French officials have increased restrictions in Paris. They have banned people from taking part in outdoor sports activities between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. The more extreme restrictions come after French politicians and doctors showed concern that Parisians were still jogging and gathering in groups. Earlier, the government had ordered people to stay in their homes as much as possible. In the Washington, D.C. area, when people continued to gather in large groups without following social distancing rules, many basketball courts and playgrounds were closed. Michelle Quinn is VOA's Silicon Valley Bureau Chief. She wrote recently about the situation in the San Francisco Bay Area. Quinn noted that a lot of people flocked to the parks, playgrounds, and beaches. The authorities had to shut them down. The areas were so crowded, health officials worried people couldn't or wouldn't stay 6 feet apart. 6 feet is about 2 meters. Even walking or riding a bicycle raises issues. If you are walking with a non-family member, you must stay at least 2 meters apart. Police can break up gatherings of more than 10 people or advise people of the distancing restrictions. Quinn noted that if you do not follow the restrictions, you may be the target of criticism, both in person and on social media. In some places, going outside for exercise or playing sports on a team are not permitted. Gyms, recreation centers, and exercise studios are not open. So some people are turning online to exercise. The physical fitness industry is also moving to online training. The Associated Press news agency contacted industry representatives and other people. Beth Berglin is the director of a charitable group in Miami, Florida. Before the pandemic, her exercise routine involved going to boot camp-style classes 4 mornings a week. Now the area where she trains is closed, but she is staying active through online classes. Part of the reason we exercise is to have that mental break, she said. I can't imagine getting through this without having some form of physical activity. Some fitness companies are changing to meet the new environment. Recreation centers and fitness studios across the United States are helping people stay active by offering online classes, some of which are free or have reduced cost. Some fitness centers are offering longer trial periods for at-home workouts. During a trial period, people can try a product or service for free. Some fitness trainers have completely moved their training programs online. Many of these online exercise classes are made for smaller spaces and do not require any special equipment. Fitness companies that have been using an online model seem better prepared than others. They are using the pandemic to expand their fitness offerings and appeal to new customers. Some of those new customers include children who are now learning at home during the pandemic. Founders of one online exercise company named Obey told the AP that they received requests for children's classes from parents. So they launched 4 10-minute dance and strength workouts for children 10 years old and younger. These days, getting exercise may be more difficult, but people are changing their behavior and are finding new ways to exercise. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
For 4 years now, to realize our vision, we have pursued a simple but profound strategy. Opportunity for all, responsibility from all, a strong, united American community.
Americans elected Clinton as their 42nd president in 1992 and re-elected him 4 years later. In the summer of 1996, President Clinton's first term was coming to an end. He had established a mixed record of successes and failures in his dealings with Congress. He had greater difficulty in those dealings after opposition Republicans won control of Congress in 1994. All presidents face political battles, but in President Clinton's case, there was more to it. He and his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were being investigated over their personal financial dealings in Arkansas during the 1980s. There were also accusations of womanizing from his years as governor of that state. But in the summer of 96, President Clinton's public ratings stayed above 50% and went as high as 60%. The economy had improved during his first term. Americans were getting jobs and spending more money. More people, and not just the wealthy, were investing in the stock market. In August of 1996, the Democratic Party met in Chicago and nominated President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore for a second term.
My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, thank you for your nomination. I don't know if I can find a fancy way to say this, but I accept.
The Republican Party held its nominating convention that summer in San Diego, California. The party chose former Kansas Senator Bob Dole as its presidential candidate. He had resigned from the United States Senate to seek the nomination. He chose former Congressman and Cabinet Secretary Jack Kemp of New York as his vice presidential running mate. Dole was a World War II hero who suffered a permanent injury to his right arm. He later served 4 terms in the House of Representatives. He was elected to the Senate in 1968 and re-elected 4 times. Another candidate in the presidential race was businessman Ross Perot. He won the nomination of the Reform Party, which he started a year earlier. He had also run for president in 1992 and received 19% of the popular vote. During the 96 campaign, President Clinton pointed to the stronger economy. He also campaigned on his legislative record, including new gun control measures and a higher minimum wage for the lowest paid workers. Bob Dole, in his campaign, accused President Clinton of spending too much. Clinton's answer was that he had stopped Congress from cutting too much from programs like health insurance for retirees. Bill Clinton and Al Gore easily won the election, defeating Bob Dole and Jack Kent. Ross Perot received just 8% of the popular vote this time. Clinton became the first Democrat to win a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. William Jefferson Clinton began his second term as President of the United States on January 20, 1997. His inaugural speech would be the last by an American president in the 20th century.
Let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century and a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs, a moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young.
Clinton discussed some of the issues that the country continued to face, including racial divisions.
The divide of race has been America's constant curse. And each new wave of immigrants gives new targets to old prejudices. Prejudice and contempt cloaked in the pretense of religious or political convictions are no different.
During his first term, President Clinton appointed a large number of women and minorities to the government. As he began his second term, he chose the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright had represented the United States in the United Nations during Clinton's first term. And he appointed the first Asian American to serve in the cabinet. Norman Mineta became Secretary of Commerce. The Republican Party kept control of both houses of Congress in the 1996 elections. At the end of his first term, Clinton had gotten into a budget fight with the Republicans, which resulted in two government shutdowns. Those shutdowns did more political harm to the Republicans than to the president. In 1997, they reached a compromise. They agreed to a plan to end the federal deficit by 2002. In fact, the budget was balanced much sooner. In 1998, the economy was so strong that the government found itself with an extra $70 billion, the first surplus since 1969. President Clinton visited China in 1998. He spoke of his belief that in the 21st century, democracy will be the right course practically as well as morally, yielding more stability and more progress. A month later, in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda terrorists bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed more than 200 people. President Clinton ordered missile strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in Sudan and in Afghanistan in an effort to kill the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. Later in the year, President Clinton ordered military action in response to Iraq's refusal to cooperate with United Nations inspectors. The inspectors were searching for nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Clinton ordered missile strikes against targets that UN officials said could have been linked to such weapons of mass destruction.
Their mission is to attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. Their purpose is to protect the national interest of the United States and indeed the interests of people throughout the Middle East and around the world. Saddam Hussein must not be allowed to threaten his neighbors or the world with nuclear arms, poison gas, or biological weapons.
In 1999, Clinton deployed American aircraft and missiles as part of a NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. NATO was trying to stop attacks against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Yugoslav military leaders agreed to withdraw their troops. NATO stopped the bombing and sent an international peacekeeping force to Kosovo. The United States provided 7,000 troops for that force. Earlier in Clinton's presidency, the United States had led NATO airstrikes against Serb targets in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia. The operations followed the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys by Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe area. Clinton later pushed for the 1995 peace agreement to end the Bosnian War. The Dayton Peace Accords were named after Dayton, Ohio, the location of the Air Force base where they were negotiated. 3 years later, in 1998, Israeli and Palestinian leaders signed a memorandum of understanding at the White House. It called for Israeli forces to withdraw from some areas of the West Bank. The Y Memorandum resulted from 9 days of negotiations at the Y River Plantation in Maryland. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Special Diplomat Dennis Ross traveled repeatedly to the Middle East to work on the peace efforts. In 2001, President Clinton tried to get Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to sign a peace agreement. Clinton invited the two leaders to the United States and held many hours of talks with them. Reports said they came close to an agreement, but the negotiations ended without success. Palestinians declared a new uprising against Israel. On trade issues, President Clinton, at the end of his second term, got Congress to approve permanent normal trade relations with China. That meant no more need for presidents to have to ask Congress for temporary renewals of those trade rights. Clinton argued that the move would create a better environment for democratic reforms in China, as well as creating jobs in the United States. Among other foreign policy matters during his presidency, Clinton normalized relations with Vietnam, and he supported the expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in Europe. Bill Clinton's presidency will be remembered, at least in part, for his efforts to reach out to the international community. But it will also be remembered for the impeachment trial in Congress that almost ended that presidency.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.